Welcome to our corner where we talk about the Streets of Avalon role-playing game. I'm Chris.
And I'm Brett.
And today we're going to talk about goblins, brain gorgers, and red caps, because we're going to talk a little bit about monsters. Next episode, we're going to talk about monster hunting. So awesome. We thought we'd start with the monsters themselves that you may or may not be hunting or helping, as the case may be.
Or befriending or fixing or whatever.
Yeah, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Let's talk about goblins first. So goblins in this world are not the same as goblins in other worlds, right, Brett?
No, they're not. So kind of traditional D&D in a lot of ways has, you know, goblin is your low level goblinoid. It's the thing you fight, right? It's a low level thing you fight at zero level or first level and so on. They're connected. Sometimes they're connected to orcs or giants or whatever the heck you have them with. And one of the things I did was I like the idea of the more fae-ish changeling type of goblin, right?
Yep.
Where goblins come, they're like, look, we're going to go take your baby, replace it with this one, take your kid, do this. So that's the type of goblin we have. The other thing that I like about goblins is from a personality perspective, they run the gamut. There's like the sealy and unsealy. There's a little more polite, hey, we're here to help. I just want to do this thing. I clean up around the blacksmith shop. You leave me bread. This is great. I'm a good little goblin. All the way to I'm a malicious little fucker. And, you know, and I live here and I, you know, I've been draining blood off of your child every night because I need that to make a thing or whatever it is it's doing. Or they're, you know, puppets or pawns or friends or servitors of evil wizard spellcaster types, that sort of thing.
That's pretty fun.
And yeah, and I like them to have, when I run goblins, I prefer them to have a decent personality of some sort. Sometimes it's that classic wheedling, sniveling, overly obsequious, oh, you great adventurer, so am I, you know, type of thing. But then they also go from that to like hard bargain drivers. I've had groups that have encountered a small pack of goblins. They're like, look, this is our section of the sewers. Go away. And they've got the whole thing walled off, spikes and spears, and they're just difficult to deal with. Yeah, you could kill them, but they're so small and they run away and then they harass you and they, and, you know, they're just impossible to get rid of. It's easier to try to buy them off or figure out what it is you're going to do to get past them. Right. How do I solve this problem? Or I guess another thing that I've used in the past is goblins are often the canary in the coal mine, if you will. Mm-hmm. And the goblins have shown up. People are like, why are there goblins here? They go down to the basement of the, you know, the wine cellar shop. And there's a small cadre of goblins down there. And like, look, we'd love to go back there, but there's a troll. No, I would totally leave. It's just there's this other horrible thing. Or there's this weird undead, or there's this were creature, or whatever it is. We had one in the original Streets of Avalon podcast we did at the, I think the second one.
Man, I don't remember that. I remember that story, but I don't remember the goblin from that.
Yeah, when you guys went down to see Urgon the Wise, there were some goblins dragging around an unconscious person.
There you go.
And sometimes goblins, they're not cannibals because people aren't goblins, so they're, but they'll eat meat.
It's fine. Everything's good here. Yeah.
Well, everything's
just
good.
I just chomped down on that. It's fine.
Mm-hmm.
They're
crafty. They're tricky. They're usually that greenish skin, under 4 feet tall, little guys. So they steal children to raise as goblins, right? That's how they make goblins. They have to go get them. Once a year, first night of winter, they go out and do that. They leave a little pouch of silver coins in the crib as payment for the kid. And once he's transformed into the goblin, they watch over it and its former family and tries to protect him. So if I steal your kid, if I'm a goblin, I steal your kid, I pay you for it. Like, hey, sorry, man, I need this. I pay you for it. And when that goblin, when that little baby that was yours is a goblin now, it pays attention to you and makes sure that your house is taken care of. It doesn't necessarily, or maybe it does, understand the familial connection to where it came from, but it does know that it cares about these people, has to make sure that they do well.
So what was, is there a feast for the first night of winter? Is there like a holiday? I can't remember.
I should know this. I'm gonna pull up my text and verify.
I mean, we do have a book that has the calendar in it.
I do have a book working on it.
That's funny. While you're looking that up, I will say that there is a goblin in my game. His name is Vladimir the Mad Tinkerer, and he's a clockwork tinkerer person, but he's also got some amount of, like, you know, magical juice because he's a goblin, right? Mm-hmm. So he's hiding out as a human being that is will fix clockwork whatever if you can find him, and he's really good at it. So one of my characters that had lost their arm, I think I've told the story on the show before,
yeah,
went to Vladimir to get a new arm built for him and made a deal with Vlad. Vlad drove a hard bargain, but it was fun to play him because the way I described him, I didn't describe him as a goblin, right? He's pretending to be a human.
Well, the cool things I like about what you just said there, too, is that it's the classic Dungeon Crawl classics is don't name the creature. Describe the creature. And I don't tell people, hi, I'm Charlie the Goblin or I'm Mary the Goblin. It's like, hey, this is my name. I live here. And these are my brothers or sisters or fathers or whatever. You know, it's got a little clan or whatever it's doing. I do not have, I just did a double verification. I do not have a first night of winter feast day.
Interesting.
Now, that doesn't mean we could not have one of that. There isn't such a thing.
There doesn't have to be. It's just then that night is even more terrifying in some ways because everybody's like just afraid of this thing happening to their kids.
It's like lock up your rooms.
So because it's a cool fairy tale. I mean, I'm sure I know it's a fairy tale from like our world in some ways. Like this is a folklore, right? Like that we are borrowing. But that means that folklore then can be transported to the Avalon setting and you're playing with it inside in the world. So like you could see this even if you're playing a campaign seated earlier being like somebody just mentioned a story, especially if kids around, like about how like, if you're not a good kid, the goblins will come and take you on the first night of winter and replace you with a very good little boy and or girl.
I like that. Yes, that makes sense. Cause I think that's absolutely what would happen. I like that. I like that a lot. Well, the other piece I was going to say is just from a like hierarchical perspective, I do have kobolds. Little lizard like dogs and goblin and kobolds hate each other.
That's funny.
Why
do they hate each other?
Same area.
Oh, okay. Underground,
territorial. Small territorial. Kobolds are more of a pain and disruptive. Goblins kind of live in the environment. Kobolds change the environment, right? So goblins are, they come from people, takes that full year for the child to turn into a goblin. You know, they've got this big change, this tell to them, they become the goblin and so on, but they're still part human and they live within and around that society. They know how to operate within it without causing too much disruption. Kobolds, they don't give a shit. Yeah.
So that's a cool piece to the goblin. I love the goblin kobold rivalry that can exist too. But I always loved the thing that you did with them where they, like you were talking about how they have to be like adherent to these families or whatever that is going on with them because they have this problem. Like they have this frenzy that they can go into if they're not with them and they'll just murder everything.
Yeah. If they get a little too far away, if things don't quite work out the way it should, you know, you push a little bit, you piss the goblin off, they get freaking nuts. You know, it's kind of the Boggart mythology. Again, what I did with these is goblins are fey, right? They're these unseelie fey where they're kind of capricious. They're little back.
They should be alien in some way too.
Yes. And they've got weird rules and things that make sense to them. And it's difficult to come at every time I've done it. When I hear someone like yourself has said, hey, my goblin did this, I'm like, I like that. Someone else has told my buddy Alpha ran a game. He's like, oh, the goblin behaved a little bit differently yet. I'm like, cool, because every goblin or group of them or whatever has its own quirk.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you could try fresh cream every morning. Maybe he doesn't want that. He wants beer. Maybe it doesn't care about beer. It wants a cat. Why? Not to eat it, but it just wants a pet. Yeah. Okay. It's weird. It likes the cat. I don't know. But that whole fae concept of their bizarre alien thinking, as you said, and they have their own rules and code. If you play within those rules and that code, you might get some help out of them, or at least not be hassled by.
Man, I love the idea of a goblin who just wants a cat to have a pet. And if the cat passes away, then like the goblin has to go into a period of mourning. But instead of a year and a day, the period of mourning is a day and an hour. And if you try to give the goblin a cat within that time, another cat within that time frame, it like flips out. But if you wait like too long, it flips out. So you have to like time it right.
Yes.
That kind of weirdness, like it makes no sense, but it makes perfect sense, right?
Again, it's the fae thing. It's the whole, everything's a little bit weird, the fae wild type of thing, but it has a bite to it.
By the way, no fae wild in this game. There's no fae wild in this game.
No fae wild. But it has a bite to it. By that, it's that unseelie piece. It has a bad side. If you do the right things, if you treat them well, and your friends, you behave properly, all that stuff is great. You flip the wrong switch, and it'll chew your leg off. Literally chew your leg off, right? It will eat your dog. It will gut your dog and leave its head in the baby's crib because it's pissed.
Yeah.
They get very vicious.
Man, we could have just done a whole episode on goblins, apparently. That would have been worthwhile.
They're fun. I wanted them to be something other than they live in an abandoned house. They live in the sewers and you got to kill them.
I will point to one other thing that we talked about that does reinforce a lot of the themes of the game. This is noir pulp, right? Which means every person is an individual and has a story. Yes. These goblins all function the same way. They're individuals with their own stories. They just don't function on the same wavelength as humanoids, the human beings and the elves and the dwarves that you might run into, but predominantly in the bargemen. So the bargemen and the humans are the most predominant people in Avalon. They just don't function on the same wavelength. They don't believe the same things.
And to be fair to any other variation of goblins in other games out there, there's nothing wrong with a more traditional D&D-ish. I love D&D too, right?
Yeah.
So having good guys, bad guys, definitive things that are monsters you can fight and so forth. This game is more about the gray areas. The world, I should say, is more about the gray areas. And do I do this? Do I beat it up? Do I threaten it? Do I kill it, take its stuff? Or do I befriend it and help it or try to figure out how to solve the problem? It's supposed to be morally gray and ambiguous. It's that noir thing. Sometimes you're doing what's right and sometimes what's, you know, effective for the moment. So
I always forget the name of the detective in the Maltese Falcon.
Oh, crap. Dashiell Hammett wrote it.
I'm just blanking on the name, but the whole time that he's like running around looking for this Maltese Falcon, there's like this thing going on in the background about his wife and his partner's dead. And at the end of the story, you find out he's the guy who killed his partner, right? Like, because he was, you know, messing around with his wife. And it's like
Sam Spade.
Sam Spade. Thank you. Great. Thank you.
I'm like, I gotta look this up. It's gonna kill me all night.
It was killing me too. I'm glad you did. But Sam Spade is not necessarily a good person, but I can understand why he did what he did.
Yep. If you watch Chinatown, not a good guy.
Not a good guy.
Not necessarily a good guy. No one in that movie is a good guy.
Well, let's talk about something that's really evil. The Brain Gorger. Hey folks, Chris here. I just wanted to jump in and say we are part of the Polygamerist Podcast Network. And with that, there's some great shows on the Polygamerist Podcast Network that you might want to listen to, like Pandas Talking Games. These are queer gamers talking about tabletop role-playing games and making outtakes. Join Pandas Phil and Senda every other Wednesday answering listener questions about playing, running, and designing TTRPGs. It's like Car Talk, but for your games. Now let's get back to the show.
Yeah.
I don't think these things have any kind of redeemable quality since they are actually servants of Erlik.
Yes. So, full transparency, I liked when I was using, you know, playing raw D&D, Mind Flayers. I love
Who doesn't
them.
Love a good Mind Flayer? Baldur's Gate 3 loves a Mind Flayer.
Exactly. I need to use these things. So what I wanted to do, though, was give them a different twist, a different spin, and so forth. So what your Brain Gorgers are, the Lichay refer to them as the enemy and realm spawn by the Church of Odin. And they're what Erlig brought, or his followers brought from different dark realms during the Soul War itself. They are key slave servants, high priests, if you will, elder things that specifically serve Erlig and his goal of absolute destruction and domination, right? The taking of the last realm. Some folks, your nutball wizard, warlock, sorcerer type, and she's like, hey, I found a hole. I'm going to go poke at that thing. Go talk to Brain Gorgers, right? Or things like that. It's not good. They're servants that were created by Erlig. They're madness-inducing things that ancient history is. There's a dwarven warlock named Tarvo Oathbreaker. He got the name Oathbreaker after the fact, who accidentally, on purpose, some say, called Brain Gorgers in, hence started the Soul War, hence started the entire invasion destruction. It was doomed for the dwarves, almost destroyed them from the entire world as a whole.
Bad.
But also forced their way in. And
the fact that they fought it off is amazing.
Yes. And by the time this had happened, you already had some lamplighters in the area. We're starting, you know, they're here. They fled. They were here between the lamplighters.
Didn't know that. Left.
Yes. The Brain Gorgers' whole thing is they want knowledge. They want, how does this work? How does that function? How do we take over this thing? They will crack you open and eat your head. Right. They gorge on your brain. And some people, now I've done this different ways. One is like a physical thing. And two, it's a literally cracking open the skull because their mouths split open weird, nasty tentacle horror shit, right? When they crack into your skull, are they withdrawing your brain or are they just somehow pulling everything out of it and then they leave you a husk?
That makes sense.
Yes. So I have used multiple different descriptions of it because very rarely has a player ever encountered one and then seen it do its work.
So currently my version is I have a, in the game, it is the psychic one. It'll crack your mind open using psychic attacks. I'm going to write another stat block for it though. That is the one that will open your head with its mouth and just eat your brains. I assume they eat brains after they've destroyed somebody's like ego or whatever. And they're just a hollowed out husk. Cause you know, they need to eat too, but you know, that is the thing that ours does right now.
I love it. Cause one of the pieces I've done in, I should say I've had folks encounter is different versions of the brain gorger, right? Some of them are a little more bestial, stronger, physical, just grunts, right? They do the thing. They're the muscle. Many of them being the player characters haven't encountered those until it gets really bad because they're kind of hard to control. The other brain gorgers are the ones that cut deals with people, try to manipulate people, are using their powers, their mind control and so forth. They're trying to, you know, suck things out of you, suck your intellect and so on. They want to learn and all that stuff. When they need to, they do have the muscle. And for me, the ones, the big physical, hyper powerful ones are the ones that like horrible gaping jaws, breaking into things and literally devouring.
That's good to know. I'll just write those up then. Yep. There's a brain gorger like lurking in the background of my campaign that I am running right now. The playtest campaign that I've been running for like, you know, 6 months now. He finally got mentioned. He's always been there, but he finally got mentioned as being like the liaison to the cult that they've been dealing with.
I love this because for me, that is one of the best places the brain gorger should be. They should be behind the scenes. If you've got a cause pyramid, if you've got a conspiracy pyramid, right, where you're trying to figure out how things lie, they are near the top. They're manipulating, they're running, they're doing, they're promising power to some poor schmo somewhere and he, she, they are running off trying to do whatever they can do, or they've got some plan, something that they're pulling off, or they're watching, trying to figure out what comes next, what happens now. Oh, this broke this person down just enough. I can now do the next thing. Their goal isn't just, you know, show up, terrify the shit out of you and eat your mind.
Well, you said it. They're trying to crack the world open for the Erlig and his compatriots to get inside. They're the forerunners, man. They're great.
Yes. And you can't get that. I shouldn't say just from. So you grab a scut boy, somebody who's just picking up trash in the street or he's emptying out chamber pots. That person isn't a wizard. That person doesn't have certain things. The more powerful you are, the more connected you are. Like, say, your magistrates, noble families, wizards, alchemists, and so forth. That's the shit that they want to get in on because those people have access to books and knowledge and understanding where things are, what's this, what's that. That's power, right? I can start to move things, change things, that can make something happen. So, again, I look at them almost like a horrible otherworldly crime boss whose job isn't just to make money, it's to destroy the world.
I mean, what cult leader isn't a horrible otherworld crime boss?
That's true. That's a very good point. Very good point.
Cool. So those are the brain gorgers. That's the function that they kind of play inside of the game. I love talking about it. They I did manage to stick in there, like they have a weakness. They don't like sanctified ground. Don't tell your players. I liked that. So I made sure it was in there, which is fun.
So and if you want, here's the reason, right? Uh-huh. So once that is effectively that ground sanctified is pure planar material. The brain gorgers aren't from here.
Yeah.
They're not from here. They can only operate in certain ways here. They have their limitations, need knowledge. They need this. They've got blind spots and so forth. Sanctified ground is like, it's taking something that is 100% opposite them. It belongs here. It is here. It is the core. It is literally the earth, the purest thing here. And then you smack them with it. Not so good. it's the same polar on a magnet, just pushing each other way. You know, it's not gonna work. Not good.
Yeah, it's so fascinating to me. I like the brain gorgers a lot because of how they function in the setting, right? They're these alien entities that are actually like alien entities from outside. They can like thin reality at places. They eat memories, essentially attack minds. Like it's not quite like a, I mean, you can see the DNA of the Mind Flayer, but it's not like a rip of the Mind Flayer.
No. And when you think, so when your characters meet these things or this thing one or plural, if they're very unfortunate, it's not a demon. It's not a devil. Demons and devils have have their own little mythology around them. Like, hey, you can cut deals with them. Oh, they'll give you knowledge. They want your soul. You know, da, da, da. This is not just you and me, bro. This is me, Mind Flayer, and the world. This is way more insidious. And this is that piece when we talked about this at the very beginning of all this. This is the time when the characters see this. This is that mind cracking. Like, where did they come from?
Yep.
Nobody talks about this. No one talks about brain gorgers. People will say the devil will get you. They'll talk about demons. They'll talk about going to hell. They'll talk about this, that, and the other thing. Wizards, the priests, and all these other folks will talk about that stuff. This shit, very few people talk about. Mm-hmm. Very few people know anything about it. And those who do are not good people, usually.
Yeah, I had to actually have that conversation with my players the other day. I'm like, look, the things that you all are dealing with are not what normal, even like not just everyday Avalonian people, but normal like adventure-y type Avalonian people, they don't deal with this stuff because they've been dealing with this cult since the very first scenario. Like it's just it's the campaign that we're playing is around these things and it's bad for them to the point where I've. You know, I've played now enough Delta Green and Call of Cthulhu, like, oh yeah, like this tag system that we have, people have gotten conditions where that have persisted for like, you need two scenarios worth of play in order for them to go away because they're mentally broken.
I have used it once, and where we had a brain gorger, and the character saw it. It was able to effectively like it, you know, psychic tearing the veil type of thing. You know, where what it did was it showed them the truth. This is what is.
Yeah.
It was that instant moment of, oh, that's Nyarlathotep and Azathoth and Great Cthulhu.
Yeah,
that's
bad.
That's real. And your brain just turns to goo and runs out your ears.
Mm-hmm.
It was horrible. You're in, you know, irrevocably unfixable insanity.
I will let everybody know that that happened in my campaign. Like they found out the truth. Like somebody, a white griffin, that's like their job is to like deal with this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like let them in on the skinny of what was going on. And then some of them saw some of this stuff. Like Pitch Alley, at least in my version of the game, is like a portal that is Erligian that these cultists can like pull up now and again.
Nice.
So somebody was in it and saw it. In our game, I let wizards, magic users have a thing called the sight, and there's somebody who's an expert that's trying to learn the magical studies skill, like training. Mm-hmm. And she's been training up, but I let her, through one of the other characters, also like utilize their sight as like a magical backlash kind of thing, and they saw Pitch Alley for what it was. And that's one of the people that's been struck with this condition of broken mind for like the last... like our last like five play sessions, and it'll finally go away. It'll finally go away during this next set of downtime.
To tag onto that, I mean, I know we're talking lore here, but the reason where I like this, the tags approach that we have is because when you're reading a lore like this, you go, oh yeah, it could do that. What's the mechanic for it? Tags.
Yep.
When you like this,
tags and conditions, man,
tags and conditions. It's wonderful. And because you write it down, it's the thing you've all agreed to. It's on the sheet. Everyone knows you've got it. You can move on from there. So I think that is it's a really good for this, you know, noir adventure, gothic horror type of thing we have. It fits really well because I can take this without having to, you know, I don't know. It just works really well.
The mythosiest stuff fits into that pulp fictiony type thing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely does.
One more monster to talk about. The red cap.
What else we got?
I love the red cap. So your red cap's based on the mythology of, or the folklore of the red cap in our societies, the different world societies that exist is drawn from there. But it's kind of the same, but a little bit different. So you want to tell us about it?
Yeah. So red caps, the generalized mythology is their hat is red because they dip in the blood of their victims and they wear it. Iron Shoes is is the idea. Hellboy fought a red cap type thing that had big iron boots.
Yep.
And he had to deal with that thing. I love having red caps with something else just besides their hat. I've had them with Iron Shoes, which is an adventure. I wrote a while back. I've had red caps with a cleaver, a frying pan, just weird stuff that they have. They've got a thing that they get a name from, right? It's Iron Shoes, you know,
the cleaver, the butcher, jack, whatever, butcher, cleaver jack, whatever, that's
whatever
good.
You want to. Because I don't want to say it's a red cap. I want to give it a name. What would you call the thing? Giants, there's a giant in mythology called Jack and Irons, right? It's this huge giant covered in chains and so on and so forth. A lot of these fake creatures had names or different local colloquial things that you would call them. Collectively, red caps. And if I want to like lump it into a box, it's easy. But I like them because they're fast. They're vicious, incredibly fucking vicious. One of my favorite things to do with them is when they die, they explode into spores.
Yep.
Right. Or their body just kind of oozes out. And then if you don't pay attention to it, you get these little mushrooms that pop up. And then pretty soon the cap of that mushroom turns red. And you wait too long. And now you got a bunch of little fuckers.
It's like gremlins. Death by gremlins.
They're hard to get rid of because they're vicious. They are usually the ones that I have done. There's a reason why they are that way. In Iron Shoes, if you run that, if you're going to play that adventure, stop listening now. I'll tell you when to come back. but if you run that one, what's happening is it's someone who died and it's angry and it's vengeful.
I love that.
And if you've got another one, it was betrayed or hurt, right? This person was, his wife ran off with him. Her lover betrayed their lover. Did a thing, or they lost their child. And because they lost their child, they're enraged, or the child lost their mother or something. It, some sort of pain, a primal pain that instead of just turning you into a despondent, whatever, it just was rage. And when that thing passes away, it becomes a red cap. And then on their little grave, boop, red cap mushroom pops up. And eventually you've got a very, very angry fey creature that is as unseelie as it gets.
I love that they're kind of like these angry face spirits, right? Like, or face spirits that are just suffused with the negative energy of an emotion.
Yes.
And that, like, I will have to figure out some way to like modify the tags at least for that. But like, there should be I should put a tag on the tag section of the stat block. That's like, put the emotion, the negative emotion that is fueling the red cap here.
Mm-hmm. I had this idea in my head that one of the first times around that adventure, like if someone could get his hat off, it would just stop. It would be hard to do. And I was running the game and somebody went, I'm going to knock his hat off. And we were playing a D&D game. They rolled a nat 20 and they had all these great bonuses. And it was just this wonderful moment. We're like, yes, the hat comes off and it falls down. Like, oh, great. So it just kind of falls down, starts dissolving. They burn the hat. They do all this stuff. And as they're leaving, my son, who was playing, was much younger at the time. AJ goes, should we put salt on that or something? And went, oh, in my head, I'm like, you little jerk. What's like you solved it. There's a way to get rid of it.
There's a way to get rid of it.
Because if you don't do it, it's the...
It'll grow back. Yeah, exactly. It'll come back.
What I want to have with this creature, and similar with the goblin and so forth, the fey things, is that they are infernally difficult to 100% get rid of. Very, very difficult. You can appease them. You can move them on. You can defeat them sometimes, but they're really difficult. And when something is this angry and this viscerally full of rage and so forth, you have to salt the earth so it won't grow. You have to iron filings. Something has to happen, right, that you can do this with. But because when the red cap Iron Shoes is literally wearing iron shoes, people are like, everyone's like, okay, obviously cold iron don't do shit to this guy. We got to do something else. So you find the salt and you use that. Again, for monsters like this, how do I solve it? Well, what do I do? How can I solve it? We've talked about this a little bit earlier today, and it was like the red cap is one of those creatures that for me, and your mileage may vary, is not, you can't change it back. You can't, it's an unredeemable thing.
Because not really the person. It's just the manifestation of a spirit, right? The manifestation of some fey anger, right?
Yes, it is.
Anger or
everything else is boiled away. Sadness. That's all that's left. Yeah, that's all that's left.
I want to see the sad red cap, right? It's just, it's constantly weeping. It's just got this tissue, this like handkerchief with it all the time. And it just makes everyone sad around it to the point where they just don't want to do anything.
Yeah, people like, they see it and then there's just dead bodies around it because they just cried it. They just sit there and weep until they die.
Uh-huh.
Or whatever, something horrible.
It's awful, right?
Yeah, it's absolutely awful.
Yeah. So like when folks pick up this book and they can see the red cap, it'll have a version of the red cap in there, but we'll put some stuff in a sidebar or near it that's like, look, you, if you have a different kind of emotion, you should probably make sure that you tailor the solve to the emotion. And we'll talk a little bit about that when we talk about monster hunting, which I think we're going to do, which we're going to do next episode. So,
oh, awesome. Very cool.
Yeah. I think that though is enough for this episode. Thanks for filling us in on those three creatures. I appreciate that.
They're fun, man. I think, like I said, I wanted to have a lot of tone and feeling. You want to maintain that noir kind of fae and all that strangeness.
Gothic horror.
Yeah. That vibe in there. And I think, with the tags and stuff, as we talked about, the conditions, I think that's just the way to go.
Mm-hmm.
It really helps.
Thank you for listening to Under the Lamplight, the Streets of Avalon role-playing game podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please like and subscribe on YouTube. You can pick up the playtest version of the game, which I've done my best to give a slightly nicer layout with some art, at polygamero.us. The link is below. And we'll see you under the lamplight next week.